Hello everyone, and thanks for tuning in to another episode of the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host Jennifer Han, and for today's episode we thought we'd touch on 2016's word of the year, and perhaps the most overused word of the year really, namely post-truth, and specifically post-truth politics. That's why Tim and I got Jemima Lovett on the podcast, who's the founder of the London Legal Forum and who recently chaired a debate about how to ensure honest elections in post-truth politics. In this episode, she shares with us some of the biggest takeaways from the event, and in the process, we touch on a whole bunch of issues from who should take responsibility, politicians, newspapers, or social media platforms, to why not just Leave, but also the Remain campaign was a post-truth campaign by omission, and why Jemima desperately wants electoral reform in the UK. If you enjoy the show, you can subscribe to us wherever you're listening to this podcast, and while you're there, do give us a quick rate and review to spread the love. You can also find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Brexit Podcast. Hi, Jemima. Welcome to the podcast.
Hi, thank you very much for having me.
So, post-truth was named the word of the year last year by the Oxford English Dictionary. For those that might not know, could you fill us in on what post-truth is, what it means?
I think post-truth is one of those buzzwords that's been thrown around a lot. Essentially, it means a truth that's been so oversimplified that it no longer is true. And that's really the age of politics that we're operating in now.
Mm. And you chaired a panel event on this topic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Could you give us a bit of a rundown of what kind of things you touched on and what maybe was your biggest takeaway from that panel?
Yeah, absolutely. So we had a really great panel with Will Moy from The Full Fact, Adrian White from the Ethical Journalism Network, Vicky Price, and Charlie Oliver from One Young World. And we looked at how post-truth had affected the Brexit campaign. So we looked at things like the 350 million quote that famously went up on the bus and was hugely criticised, and what impact that had, whether if it had been 250 million or 150 million, would that have affected the result? And the conclusion people were coming to on the panel and in the audience was that actually it was an emotional response rather than a factual economic argument that was being put forward. And that was an interesting tangent, really, to the whole discussion. I think the post-truth element has resulted in maybe a more emotional response from people in the electorate.
So that 350 million that you talk about there, that was something that the Leave campaign kept repeating, didn't they, in terms of how much they felt that our membership of the European Union was costing us?
Mm. Yes, correct.
Okay, so I find that point really interesting about the emotionality of it, because I think it's just, that is what makes people believe in something that might not be completely logical or completely factual, right? If they emotionally feel it to be true. Do you think that's something that's getting more common then?
I think certainly in terms of student activism, there's a greater response from students emotionally, and engagement levels are much higher than they have been, say, 10 years ago now, as a result of this sort of strange world that we're operating in where everything seems to be in flux. And that has created a lot more emotion, certainly from most of my peers and at this conference. You know, it was extremely well attended for an early Saturday morning. And I think that just in itself said a lot about how important this was. The other thing about the emotional response is the response from Remainers to the £350 million quote was really interesting. I think people were responding with much more sort of violent outrage than they would do to other political lies that they've become used to over the years. And that was really because they respected the importance of this issue, and that other people were responding so strongly against the idea of money being sent to Europe, they wanted to respond back.
Mm. I'm actually quite curious about that, because you just touched on the fact that there have always kind of been lies within politics, right?
Mm.
That's always, I think it's just this sort of common cultural knowledge of like, oh yeah, politicians lie.
I think to people our age, absolutely, definitely. But my mum talks about politicians as people who you really respect. And she kind of comes from a generation where you really respected policemen, you really respected doctors.
Mm.
And we're almost moving into a world where we don't respect these people because we don't trust them completely. It's almost like they've lied a bit too much, and we've moved beyond trusting our prime minister. And that respect is maybe changing in
2016. Was there some thoughts on the panel where how we can get that respect back then?
Well, certainly Adrian from the Ethical Journalism Network was very pro some regulation and felt the Electoral Commission should maybe take on a regulatory role around what you're allowed to campaign on. And if I think his sort of mindset was that the £350 million quote would have resulted in the Leave campaign having some sort of striking off or being sort of told off in some way. I don't know how that would look in practice, but that was certainly his perspective. On the other side, you had Will Moy, who was very against that because he saw it as censorship. So yeah. I think that's the debate you've got there.
I'm quite curious, there's been some talk in the wake of the US election, certainly as well, that there should be some sort of live fact-checking thing when transmitting things, like speeches or something like that. So to have maybe a box in the bottom of the screen saying, actually, this is da-da-da. Do you think that's something that could be implemented, and do you think it would be a good idea?
It's certainly something that can be implemented. I was in New York at the time of debates with Clinton and Trump, and they had fact-checkers doing that live in New York. And it was very interesting. I mean, you know, Hillary Clinton was lying as well, and that damaged her. I think today in the UK, we don't have enough fact-checking in debates, and that's something that should be done, because it's definitely possible full fact do it. Every time that there is an election speech, they're fact-checking throughout. So I think that should be given more precedence by like, the BBC, maybe.
Yeah. But if you have the people in power who are making different calls, and then who fact-checks the fact-checkers?
You know? Oh, of course. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, we did touch on that. I don't think we came to any big conclusions. I don't know where full fact, what their system is on that. I guess you kind of have to at some point trust someone.
Yeah.
But you raise a really good point. And also, how do you calculate it? Because we looked at the £350 million and we looked at what would have been an accurate figure. And actually, there's like six different ways to calculate how much money we send to the EU every week. Like, it's like one person says 170 million, another person says it's more like 220. And I mean, these are respected economists who are trying to work it out. It's actually quite a hard thing, you know, to say.
And I suppose if you are going to sanction people that embellish the truth, shall we say, then an apology in this instance wouldn't be good enough, would it? You'd have to have a retraction on the level of the initial statement.
Presumably. And we see that with Donald Trump. He sort of, people say, but at least he apologises.
He doesn't really apologise.
He apologises on Twitter. So, you know,
if he even does, I feel like mostly he's like, I never said that. And then he'll show the clip and he's like, well, that's not what I meant.
Yeah.
Like, you said it, though.
Yeah, I get it.
Just sticking with the fact-checking thing for a moment, I picked up a point from Alexios Mantzalis, probably pronunciations all over the place there, from the Poynter Institute, said the interest in fact-checking's never been higher. You kind of mentioned that. Do you think there's a flip side? So you've got post-truth on the one side. Do you think, therefore, you get something that goes on the other side, which says we must have integrity? Is there a drive through that? And if so, who's leading the charge there?
Well, I suppose people like Adrian and the Ethical Journalism Network, who are really pro this idea of some sort of regulation being put in place. I guess 6 months ago, I would necessarily have supported that idea. I think I would have said that's bordering on censorship. We have to learn to trust our politicians rather than regulating them. It's kind of like a similar discussion you have with quotas. You know, you shouldn't need to have quotas. You should just encourage diversity in a more genuine way.
Yes.
But maybe you should just encourage people to be honest rather than needing to constantly regulate them. Because again, you raise a really good point that who's going to check the fact checkers? And you get yourself into a kind of collision that isn't ever going to be resolved.
I think we
maybe
could
just all be more honest. Some crazy idea.
Yeah, or maybe the conclusion to this episode is just truth is relative. Like, there is no truth. There's no such thing. I was thinking about this as well, because there's so much information, and you can find pretty much anything to corroborate your statements if you just look hard enough. I feel like there's so much information out there that you can pretty much find any type of information, and there will be some kind of truth to it. And I think maybe for people, it's so easy to believe in simplifications because they simply have no time to even grasp the amount of information that's out there. But then obviously they don't want to trust experts anymore, as that famous quote was. So I don't even know if I'm asking a question. I'm just
putting out like a dystopian vision right now.
Do you think it's kind of like resulting from sort of social media and a Twitter attitude, or people being too busy to really read a newspaper properly anymore? You kind of get halfway through the first paragraph, if I'm lucky, on the train to work, you know, and I just pick up the headline points.
Totally. And clickbait, I think, you know, you see that with clickbait headline, instant gratification, disposable. We had the German...
We're touching on all the buzzwords today.
We had German journalist Isabella Garin on the podcast, it'll be a week ago when you listen to this one. And she talks about the rise of social bots, and about how basically creating kind of, you know, robots online that just retweet propaganda constantly.
But there's a whole industry in Romania of people just writing fake news articles to get clicks. And that is, you know, I mean, that's not even people saying this is truth. Like, they know that it's lies and they're putting it out there. And your Twitter feed and your news, your Facebook reflects your own political views, because it reflects...
And I guess the reason we're talking about this is it because it works, and then the more people find out that it works, and then it's like, well, actually, we keep it. In terms of the Brexit campaign, we talk about 350 million. Were there some other post-truths that came out of that that were impactful, or was it always focused on that figure? Putting you on the spot with this one.
I think it was mainly focused on that figure, because one of the initial questions was about the £350 million, so we kind of focused on that trait. But I think other things that came up were things like not having a plan, not being an excuse for lying.
Yes.
So, the issue that comes up with students on this one is the status of international students after they finish their studies, which is perilous with leaving the EU. And I think they were trying to understand why someone could run a campaign and not have that set in fact either way on both sides. Why was it not clearer what the status of people would be after we leave the EU if we were going to vote for Brexit? Why was that not more obvious? And why do people not know if they're going to be able to stay in the UK, you know, having guaranteed people's statuses? I'm not saying we should do that. I understand why politically it's controversial, but at the campaign stage, why was that not laid out more clearly?
Yeah, so Remain was basically not lying by omission, but sort of
not telling a whole truth.
Yeah, of course, that makes sense. I think there's been a lot of arguments about Remain maybe not doing what it should have been doing.
Yeah, well, both sides as well. I mean, both sides can be criticised quite heavily for how they ran their campaigns.
I agree. I concur.
Of course, it's always so easy to sit here and criticise. I wouldn't have run a campaign particularly necessarily, but...
Yeah, so I think there was, at the end of last year, there was a complaint made to the Crown Prosecution Service that said that the Leave campaign should be held accountable for the claims it made, that there should be some kind of legal action taken against them. Is that realistic? How often does something like that happen? Like, can we actually hold politicians accountable when they say things that simply aren't true and then win campaigns based on it?
This came up actually towards the end of Reb Law, and Will really argued against litigating our way out of Brexit. Because it's sort of like, who's going to regulate the fact checkers? You're kind of trying to excuse something, and instead you should be trying to move positively forward. And I think a lot of the students were saying, we should be able to sue Boris Johnson, we should be able to take Michael Gove to court.
Right.
And actually that's, I mean, you're talking to a whole bunch of law students, so their response is there must be a way to remain in general. Mm. There were some Leave people in the room who stood up and asked questions as well. So there was quite a sense of debate going on, but certainly pro the legal system, and certainly feel that judges should be able to have some role in managing the executive. And then we got into a really interesting conversation about Gina Miller's campaign and the role of judicial review and whether that kind of legislative power should be curtailed in some way, and the executive should be looked after by a judiciary, and the relationship between that separation of powers.
Can you give us a little bit of a recap on Gina Miller? She was a guest on episode 9, spoke to Jen. But yeah, because Gina Miller was the one who took the government to court over Article 50, wasn't she?
Took the government to court over Article 50 because Theresa May wanted to use royal prerogative to enact Article 50, and that is quite an old-fashioned approach, and mostly these days we have a debate before an Act of Parliament is passed, or indeed before anything happens, really. Royal Prompter was back in Henry VIII's time.
Yes.
So, that was a really interesting...
Which was kind of interpreted as going against the will of the electorate by a lot of commenters.
Interestingly,
that royal prerogative would have been their preference, given that that was something that was moved away from with giving powers to Parliament to give a voice to the electorate.
Did you come to a conclusion about whether it was better to sort of put legal challenges to these people, or whether it was better to move positively forward and try and do something constructive?
I think moving positively forward and trying to do something constructive was definitely the way that the panel was trying to encourage the students. I think some of the students probably still left wanting to take Michael Gove, Boris Johnson, Nigel Farage straight down to probably the Tower of London. Just forget the RTJ. Yeah. But, I think there was a sort of move towards moving positively forward. And it's very difficult to talk to a generation where the vast majority of people voted to remain, and that they're going to live with it, and they're sort of living with this, a situation that they didn't necessarily make.
What was the general mood like?
Well, it was just after Trump was elected.
Oh, Jesus.
So it was very, almost kind of depressed.
Right,
to start with. And the questions, we had people lining up down the side of the room to ask questions, and we sort of had to take them in groups of six. And then I was scribbling away, trying to, recap. Mm-hmm. So just a huge amount of engagement. And, I set up the London Legal Forum 2 years ago, and we ran a debate in January looking at the repercussions of Brexit, and we had about 30, 40 people turn up. I mean, this was much higher level of engagement.
Yeah.
I think we were probably one of the only law societies to sit down and ask what would be the repercussions of Brexit before it happened back in January, because no one thought it was going to happen.
Yeah.
And so no one really thought it was a relevant debate to have.
And if you had a message for the wider public, to stress, I guess, how important this topic is and how they should be engaged in this issue about post-truth politics, what would that be?
I think demand more complicated answers. As I think when you start to demand people to talk for a little bit longer, when you ask your MP a question and they answer in one sentence, ask more, dig deeper, I think then you find out what they really think and what they really mean underneath the rhetoric that they try and protect themselves with.
Good advice, definitely. Right, Jemima, you said that you had Charlie Oliver from One Young World on the panel as well. Can you explain a little bit about who One Young World are? Sound like a boy band.
Well, they're actually a really, really fantastic conference that happens every autumn. And this year it was in Ottawa, and I was very lucky I was able to go, I was sponsored to go. And it's all about bringing young people together from every country in the world, who sort of have leadership potential or are doing something in their communities to make a difference, and getting them to collaborate in one room. And it really creates fireworks. You get some great projects coming out of it. It's very inspirational. They have fantastic speakers. Emma Watson this year, Kofi Annan. Everyone who's interesting comes along and gives their bit. And they also have delegate speakers come up and say what they're doing. So it's a really, really great conference. And Charlie, he was the coordinating ambassador for the London region for the last 2.5 years, and has grown that to be a really active network with really regular conferences and debates going on throughout the year leading back up to the autumn event. And he's now become the coordinating ambassador for Europe, so he's leading that charge, which is really, really great. And he had some great stuff to say at the conference, all about youth activism and how young people work together and collaborate in a totally different way to people a generation before us. And how One Young World is kind of capturing that spirit and enthusiasm and engagement to move things forward in a more positive sense. I think a lot of young people feel quite depressed with the situation at the moment. As a generation, we didn't vote for this result of the Brexit result. But nonetheless, we want to be engaged and involved in what happens next. And that's very difficult, because there's very few millennials in Parliament, very few millennials being given a voice. But something like One Young World and the level and platform that it gives people, and the work that people like Charlie do allows young people to have that voice and to reach their politicians and reach decision makers. And okay. he was trying to encourage people to really engage with that opportunity to say what they think.
And through what medium? Snapchat?
Well, I think One Young World gives people the opportunity to write blogs and put things online, and then it passes them on to decision makers. But it also creates events where politicians will come and listen and speak, but then listen to the questions afterwards and engage. But obviously we would like there to be more young people engaged in the process inside Parliament and inside ministers' offices and inside the civil service. So they're trying to encourage that.
Yeah. We also had Youth Group Undivided on the podcast a few months ago.
Yeah.
It's along similar lines,
similar
I think.
Similar concept, yeah. Very much so, yeah.
And you also mentioned about Vicky.
Yeah. Well, Vicky Price, obviously a fantastic economist, former joint head of the Government Economic Service, and she had some really interesting arguments on the economic side of things, speculating a lot on why the Remain campaign appeared to move away from their economic arguments, which were so central when they started, the leaflets that were posted to everyone.
Right.
You know, really, that was a headline move forward, was that you'll be poorer outside of the EU. And yet over time, they kind of left this idea behind. And she actually was sort of saying, well, maybe it's because they realised they couldn't substantiate what they were saying. And maybe it was because they were worried that they were going to be lying.
Okay.
Which is quite interesting.
So they were brought down by their own integrity.
Yeah, they were brought down by their own integrity, whilst the Leave campaign have this issue and just went with it. So an interesting interpretation of the situation there.
Yeah, because there's always that saying, it's about the economy, stupid, when it comes to elections, you know.
Yeah,
it all boils down to the economy, right? At the end of the day.
Yeah, are you going to tax me more?
Yes.
You
know?
And you would have thought that Remain had the perfect argument in the economic argument. And actually, when I think back, I don't think it featured that much or enough. And that's one of the things Remain are criticised for the most.
Well, they certainly had the status quo, didn't they? And people generally don't like change.
Mm.
So they had the ability to say, well, if you vote Leave, everything is going to be so much worse.
Yeah.
And what we've got at the moment actually isn't that bad.
Yeah. I mean, they maybe did that a bit too much, the kind of panic approach of, like, it's all going to be awful if you leave, we're just going to scaremonger.
That didn't go down so well, because you sort of had people like Andrea Leadsom on the Andrew Marr show being like, oh, for goodness sake.
Yeah, don't get the other way.
You know, taking that approach. But yes, you're absolutely right. They had a great argument, and you know, people like my mum responded that I just can't bear the idea of all the paperwork that leaving the EU is going to create. And she has a point. I mean, it's, you know, just the act of leaving costs an awful lot of money, and people respond to that and say, well, that's clearly going to cost me money, so therefore I'll stick with the status quo. That argument doesn't seem to feature. At least that
Do you talk about electoral reform at all, and whether for the next general election it should be done differently? Did that feature?
Yeah, we had hoped to have some from the Electoral Reform Society on the panel, actually, but sadly they couldn't make it on a day. But I think the electoral reform definitely came up along the lines of regulation, and maybe actually the whole system is broken. And certainly, I mean, there were wide-ranging debates from let's end the first-past-the-post system and move towards an American system. not the electoral college system, but I mean of having your vote for Parliament, your local MP, and then your vote for the Prime Minister being separate.
Yep.
I mean, I think I've voted always, all different parties in my very few number of elections that I've had a chance to vote in, but I think I've always felt that I wanted to vote one way for my local MP and a very different way for my Prime Minister.
Right, okay.
Because often your local MP, it's like the person who you know and the person who you kind of have a respect for in the community, and the other politicians just aren't local or don't seem to understand local issues. But that isn't the same need as when you vote for your Prime Minister. I don't care if they know about Guildford's recycling issues.
So in a way, personally, you like to see powers devolve more.
Yeah, a little bit, yeah. Certainly within, between the executive and the legislative, I definitely think there's room for reform. And things like the Supreme Court being created in 2005 has created a much greater separation with the judiciary. I think that's a real risk, because suddenly the executive and the legislative have got a lot more power and the balance that has been shifted. And that's a risk because...
Can you explain that a little bit more, just for the sort of uneducated non-lawyers out there? Or for me?
No, so you have a judiciary, and you have an executive, and you have a legislative. So the legislative is parliament, they legislate. The executive is government, they execute the will of the people. The judiciary is judges, they judge on issues of law and on what Parliament's acts actually mean in a day-to-day case-by-case scenario. And the relationship between those three is historic and really central to the UK constitution, because you've got statute, you've got case law, they all feed into each other. And the separation of power is really important, but the balance between those three is crucial. Because if you have an executive that has too much power, you get a parliamentary dictatorship, and you end up with a government that can pretty much just do what it wants and isn't subject to anything else. So it's things like Tony Blair didn't turn up to PMQs that much that cause issues, because he took too much power into the executive, moved power away from Parliament, didn't give them a chance to scrutinise what he was doing, and some would say over the period of his premiership, became more of a dictator over time. And that relationship is really important. We have a system here where our executive is born out of our legislative, which is why this issue of the two being too close is so important and so dangerous, because if you have an executive that are turning into a dictatorship and they have a huge majority in Parliament, then you don't have anyone scrutinising. And that's a situation we've got now, with Parliament having such a weak opposition, there's no scrutiny, more or less, of the executive decision.
Beautifully explained.
I doubt whether that was really good.
Yeah, okay. That was really good.
So how do you rate the odds of there being any kind of reform in that regard?
Very poor, because we have an elected dictatorship. Uh-huh.
Fair enough. That's a great way to end that. Well, I actually wanted to ask one last question that's kind of pertaining to Tim and I, because we're part of the quote-unquote media, and I think... So,
I don't know where the quote-unquote
media comes from. Well, you know, the media, and...
Yes.
It's just, I think a lot of people talk, when it's post-truth politics, that sort of implies that politicians are the ones doing something wrong. But I think maybe a part of it is that media is also inherently doing something wrong, because we're valuing, like, the commodity now isn't information or facts, it's attention, because that's how we get money and how we sustain ourselves. So I think there's a massive issue there, and how the media maybe should be criticized more. Would you agree with that as well?
In defence of the media, with the move for everything digital now, the media's finding it incredibly difficult to make any money. And therefore...
Therefore,
you can criticise, but it needs to be...
I agree with you. It's a huge issue that the media is a business. And you're comparing politicians who are there for the public service with... something that's supposed to be money-making. So maybe our media shouldn't be money-making. Maybe it should be publicly owned. That's one solution, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Not one that I would support, but it is one solution.
Yeah.
The other issue maybe with the media is that it hasn't regenerated enough to match the world in which it now operates. I never buy a newspaper, because I hate getting the black ink on my hand.
Mm-hmm.
Newspapers come from a time when people had butlers to iron them, so that didn't happen. And I think, actually, newspapers almost need to stop printing if they really want to be sustainable. And they need to stop having offices. They need to start just being online.
I would like to point out that we are currently in a newspaper office.
It's a lovely office. But it's totally unnecessary.
You're not being invited back.
But do you know what I mean? It's totally unnecessary. I mean, most student newspapers aren't run, and they create good content, intelligent, interesting articles. And you have really great journalists, so you don't want to lose that. You have really, really intelligent people writing really interesting things. Like, I love reading newspaper articles. I find them, I read newspaper much more newspaper created content than I do books these days. And I have a Time subscription, a digital subscription, because that's what I want to read.
But that's good, because I was going to ask you, how do you pay for this news? Because news has a value.
To create it, it has a value.
And it's a pillar of society, and probably goes right back to what the start we were talking about. If we want to try and hold politicians to account, then we need good journalists as an independent pillar of society, don't we?
Yeah, but then we can't depend on third parties like advertisers if we're supposed to hold people to account, because then that inevitably makes us dependent on a third party interest.
That's why we all need to value news more and pay our Time subscriptions.
But how likely is that? Because I feel like there's so much of a tendency now, people read more news than ever. But
yeah, you're absolutely right. Yeah. People read, I can meet
that
with friends.
That goes to your point about
like,
the whole industry not regenerating fast enough to keep up with.
But then what is the alternative, though?
Well, don't print. Don't worry about printing.
Support podcasts like this. Join our new Patreon team.
I don't know. I mean, there is a way, there is a place for printing. Like, I do like getting The Economist sometimes, but I wouldn't buy a daily newspaper. And I think you'd struggle to find someone my age who buys daily newspaper.
But I also think you might be quite a rarity in that you pay for an online subscription, because I don't know anyone my age who does.
Okay.
And if it's not financed through advertisers, because we were saying that might make it biased, and if it's not financed through online subscriptions, what is the alternative? How do journalists get paid? What do you think?
I would cut costs by not necessarily having offices and not printing, and then I would insist on it being paid. But I think you've got to have almost like an agreement between you guys who have a subscription, The Telegraph and like The Guardian, as the three newspapers that I kind of think of as reputable.
Yeah.
Like broadsheet newspaper, Financial Times, and you could all agree that you're all going to charge a membership and you're all going to have the same subscription. So whether you're a bit more right wing and therefore you read a certain newspaper, a bit more left wing, you read a certain newspaper or whatever, you can just make that choice.
Okay, but then do you think it's just going to be that sort of free blogs come in, or all these sort of little news websites that are popping up everywhere that are the ones spreading these fake news stories, but they might come in and take the readership from the companies that are now charging subscription fees?
But I mean...
You mean like Mail Online?
Oh, God.
I think people recognise those sites for what they are, really.
Yeah.
I hope they do.
But then the issue is, I think...
I like reading, I know certain journalists that I enjoy reading, and I'll only get those by paying my Time subscription.
Yeah.
So you've kind of got to sell that, I suppose. And there are really good journalists with all the main newspapers, and you've kind of almost got to have a bit of a branding thing going on with all of that.
Yeah. I think it's very easy to recognise those sites for what they are, as you said, when you're on the actual website. But because so many people get their news through social media now, it's all in this feed. And it's not very clear what the branding is straight away, because it's a bit smaller than it would be. So you see the article and the headline, and then most people don't even click through to the article, right? They just assume the facts from the title of the article without necessarily even looking at who published it.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to say that I think there might be a bit of danger there.
So do you think those sites should be closed down by like either Facebook or like the UK government?
But then is that censorship? It probably is
on some level.
But then, Facebook isn't really taking responsibility for anything right now, so I don't think we can... That's another thing, calling for responsibility from Facebook for unbiased... Yeah.
They always don't want to be the arbiter of truth.
Yeah. It's because they pretend they're not a media company. They pretend they're, like, a software company, but they're clearly a media company, and Mark Zuckerberg is the editor, but he just doesn't want to admit it, because he's high and mighty.
But I suppose they don't generate the news, do they? Mark Zuckerberg, obviously... does write Facebook, but he doesn't sit down and write blog articles on Brexit.
Yeah, but then, the editor of The Times doesn't write it either. He, like, curates it into a thing, and that's basically what Facebook does, right? It curates articles into a thing, and then that has some kind of bias inevitably in it. Same as Twitter.
Yeah, I don't think we're going to solve this one in one.
I wish we did. Oh, it'd be amazing. Imagine if we came up with the solution.
Yeah, I think education in schools is a big
thing. education.
Jemima, thank you ever so much for being a guest and popping in to see us today. It's been really enjoyable.
It's been great. Thank you.
I As always, thanks for listening. And if you enjoy the show, please subscribe to us on your podcast platform of choice so you'll be notified whenever we upload a new episode and you'll be able to tune in. In the meantime, you can find us at brexitpodcast.com and on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at brexitpodcast. The show is produced by Jennifer Han, Tim Hemming, and Warren Paul, and our theme song is Cool Vibes by Kevin MacLeod.